So again, yesterday I was trying to catch up. Okay, first of all, there's two new sets of lecture notes on the wiki. Well, lecture 7 was there yesterday. I think I just forgot to tell you guys about it. But that's okay because we're not going to cover that. We're just starting to cover those notes today. And then lecture 8 is also up on the cosmic microwave background and Big Bang nucleosynthesis, both of which were basically discovered. The idea was discovered by one person who should be much more famous than he is, one of the great geniuses of the 20th century, Gamov, who also has a crucial other connection to this course. He was from Odessa and was a huge compendium of Odessan jokes. That's true. So in his honor, let's begin with at least one of those. So two rival businessmen meet at the train station, and they're clearly going somewhere. And businessman number one says to the other one, you know, oh, where are you going? And number two says, to Minsk. And number one says, I know you tell me that you're going to Minsk just because you want me to think you're going to Pinsk, but I know you're actually going to Minsk. Why did you lie to me? It's the whole joke. It's the whole joke. It's okay. There's two towns. Is it clear? There's two towns in the former Soviet Union, Minsk and Pinsk, which commonly feature in jokes for no better reason than the fact that they sound silly when said in the same joke together. They sound... So businessman number one says to his rival, where are you going? And he says, the rival says, Minsk. And he says, I know you're just telling me that because you want me to think you're going to Pinsk, but I'm too clever for you. I know you're going to Minsk. Why did you lie to me? It's hilarious. What does it take? There's like the surface layer and the deeper layer. This joke has depth, I think. Anyway, okay, that one's not good enough for you. So I'll save another one for the middle of the court, for the middle of the lecture, because that one bombed. So what is our task today? Our task today is to begin to learn about thermodynamics and statistical mechanics in the expanding universe, first of all, because that's just crucial to understand some of the most basic features of how the universe evolved. But also, again, we're getting into this part of the course where we want to at least sketch the basic idea of how, the early universe is the ultimate high-energy particle accelerator. It apparently achieved extremely high temperatures and densities and energies that are unachievable in laboratories on the Earth. And, one of the things that can happen is that relics of those early, ultra, very exotic phases of the universe's evolution can stick around to the present day, and we want to see how to calculate when and to what extent that happens. And the basic idea is if you sometime 3 years from now, you will have a new theory of everything. You'll think you have the new theory that solves it all, and you should check when you have a new theory that solves everything. You should check not just that it matches the data from the Large Hadron Collider, but also that if this theory was really right, and it was right throughout the whole history of the universe, that the universe today wouldn't be swamped with, giant, super heavy particles that would be completely in contradiction with what we know about the universe today. So this, it's very important to know the basic idea of how to check that your theory is not totally inconsistent with cosmology, because a lot of theories are. So just to get started. So this is the first section of lecture 7. We just need some of the basic formulae governing the... So if we have a species... Well, so to get started, classical statistical mechanics is formulated often in phase space. So the space labeled by the full set of positions and momenta. And an important quantity is the distribution function, fi of x, p, and t. The distribution function describing the ith species of particles. We might have a bunch of different particles, right-handed circularly polarized photons, left-handed circularly polarized photons, electrons, right-handed electrons, left-handed electrons, et cetera. Okay, and so the, you know, this distribution function is nothing but, you know, the definition of this thing is just that if I take a little box, little infinitesimal box in phase space, whose volume is d cubed x times d cubed p, the probability that when I look in that box, I will find a particle of species I is its distribution function times the volume of that box. Okay. So, you know, in particular, if I want, so once I have the distribution function, oh, I should say, so I'm not going to derive this here, but I want to at least mention it. It does play an important role in cosmology. The differential equation that this guy obeys, it obeys some partial differential equation called the Boltzmann equation, which is very important in cosmology. And, you know, the collisionless Boltzmann equation, the Boltzmann equation has this general form that it's a bunch of differential operators, some differential operator that acts on F, that's the left-hand side, and then there's some collision term, which is also a function of F on this side. And the idea here is that if this guy is zero, then that equation, that's the so-called collisionless Boltzmann equation, and that says, that just says, you know, if I tell you that the distribution function is f of x, p, and t, some particular function at some initial time t, so some initial time t zero, let's say, you know, this equation lets you solve for what it will look like at later times, and it can just be derived by saying, well, in the absence of collisions, all that each particle described by this equation will do is just stream along its geodesic through the space-time. And you can just ask, you know, how does this, if I just let all of the particles described by this distribution function start with some distribution and then just go off streaming along their along the geodesics determined by their initial position and initial momentum, you know, those geodesics will tell me where this x gets moved to at a later time, where this p gets moved to at a later time. So anyway, that's it's a good exercise, but one we won't do now, to just derive what the collisionless part of the Boltzmann equation is. And then to calculate this part, you actually need to know some more detailed physics about the model. If the particles start hitting each other, you know, what are the rules for, what are the scattering cross sections, what are the scattering amplitudes for, you know, two particles, three particles going to n particles. Anyway, I just wanted to mention that's what the Boltzmann equation is, but we're not going to need that in this lecture, so we're going to skip over it. So let's first say the three things that we are going to need a lot are the number density, the number of particles per physical volume, per physical spatial volume of the ith species, the energy density of the ith species, the amount of energy per physical volume, and the pressure. Okay, and if I give you the distribution function, Fi, you can calculate each of these guys as follows, okay? So, you know, first of all, if I want to calculate the number density, well, the distribution function is the if you want, the number of particles per volume density and per momentum density, per volume in real space and volume in momentum space. Now here I just want per volume in real space, so I should just integrate over this whole strip in momentum space. So that's it. So if I just want to get the number density from the distribution function, I do it that way. And now if I want to get the energy density, that's the energy per unit volume. So this is, it's just the same thing, but weighted by the energy, you know, in this, the energy per unit volume is just the energy per six volume integrated over the integrated over the momentum 3 volume. So in other words, again, this expression is just intuitively clear, where E here, if this is just a normal relativistic particle, E is given by the usual formula in terms of P. It's the square of P plus the particle's mass squared. And finally, the pressure, the formula for the pressure is the one that, requires a little bit of thought. So it's given as follows. Okay, so why is that? First I remind you that, when you have charged particles, when you have some charged fluid, there's some charged current, and it's the amount of let's put it this way, that if you have a particle of charge Q and you want to calculate its contribution to the charge current density, well, it just contributes a charge current that's like this, right? Now, the stress energy tensor T mu nu has the physical interpretation that so I'm introducing the stress energy tensor because remember P and rho are two different parts of the stress energy tensor. So to derive that equation to understand where that equation for P is coming from, let's just remember what the stress energy tensor means. So this stress energy tensor has just one index because it's the current in the mu-th direction of a scalar quantity, the charge. T mu nu has a different interpretation. It's the current in the mu-th direction of the momentum P nu. Okay? So the nu-th component of momentum. Okay, so we expect something like, we expect it to look something like, instead of Q, P nu here times dx mu dt. But now remember that the four momentum P mu is dx mu d tau. So if we multiply and divide by d tau here, this is P nu, and then I can just write this as P mu over P zero. Okay, is that clear? So P zero is just the, what is the pressure? Well, the pressure is extracted from the stress energy tensor. Remember that for a perfect fluid, the stress energy tensor has some form like its diagonal and it's minus rho PPP. With zeros on the off diagonal. And so here you can see the trace of the stress energy tensor, this trace of the spatial part of the stress energy tensor is 3p. So one third of the trace is really what the pressure is. And that's true more generally. So what we really want to do here is take the spatial trace of this guy. So that's really just p spatial vector squared over P0, which is E. And then again, we take one third of the trace. Okay, so that's where this expression is coming from. So that's in general, if you had a general out of equilibrium distribution function, how you would calculate. If I gave you Fi, an arbitrary distribution function, you could go ahead and calculate the number density, pressure and energy density of the particles. But yeah.
Sorry, you probably said this, but are you labeling a particle species by I?
Yes, that's right. So in normal cosmology lingo, the particle, the I label labels every different species. Like the way I think about it is once you've specified a momentum direction, what else do you have to tell me to specify exactly what particle I'm talking about? So, if I specify momentum direction, you still have to tell me that it's a photon, and you also still have to tell me what its polarization is. There's two possible choices for the polarization. So I would be that label that tells me both what particle we're talking about and what polarization of the particle we're talking about. So every different polarization of the photon is a different species I, and every different particle, photon, electron, and so forth are different species. So now we're going to be particularly interested in the case where the distribution function is the thermal one. So here, I'm not going to derive this, but hopefully you've seen this before, or came across it in undergrad or in the statistical mechanics course earlier in the course here. The idea is that in thermal equilibrium, for an ideal gas in thermal equilibrium, if I take a little box, you know, remember dx times dp, that has units of h bar. And if I take a little box of size d cubed x, d cubed p, if I take a box whose size is equal to Planck's constant cubed, or in other words, 2 pi h bar cubed, then in thermal equilibrium, the species I, the expected number of particles of species I in that box of this size is given by the Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distribution. So it's given by exponential of E minus mu I, the so-called chemical potential of that species, divided by Ti, its temperature, the temperature of that species, and then minus plus 1, where the minus sign is for bosons. That makes the Bose-Einstein distribution. The plus sign is for fermions. That makes this the Fermi-Dirac distribution. Okay, so in other words, the density in phase space is in thermal equilibrium is 1 over h cubed of that. If you plug that into those expressions, then an exercise on the upcoming homework is to work out to evaluate those expressions in two important limits where they simplify and that give you sort of the basic qualitative tools you need to analyze cosmological evolution. Okay, so the first limit that you'll work out is that the first is the relativistic limit. So in that limit, you'll calculate that the number density of particles of the ice species, the number per physical volume, is given by zeta of 3. That this is just the zeta function, just some number, divided by pi squared times the temperature of that species cubed. The energy density is given by, I don't know, the prefactors here are obviously, they're not crucially important, but I happen to have written them down so many times in my life that I know them. And so in this limit, the expressions are given by this. The only really important point these prefactors are not important to remember. They're all of order 1. They're just numbers of order 1. The important thing is that in this limit, you could have just predicted these answers apart from these prefactors just by dimensional analysis, that in the relativistic limit, so the relativistic limit is the limit where the temperature, which sort of sets the typical energy scale of the particles, is huge relative to their mass. Their chemical potential and their mass are both negligible relative to the temperature. So in that limit, the temperature is the only game in town. It's the only dimensionful quantity in town. So, I mean, I could have just predicted, I could just ask myself, what units do these three quantities have? And how many powers of temperature do I need to get the right units? Okay. So, I mean, just to be clear, if I work in units where, you know, hopefully you've seen this, that if I work in sort of natural units where particle physicists' units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1, then energy, and K Boltzmann, Boltzmann's constant. Then energy has the same dimensions as mass, has the same dimensions as temperature, has the same dimensions as 1 over length, has the same dimensions as 1 over time. So number per unit volume is just a dimensionless quantity over volume, which is length cubed. So that's energy, temperature to the third power. Whereas this is energy per unit volume, so that's energy, which is temperature, divided by volume, which is temperature cubed. So just on dimensional grounds, you could have predicted these formulae up to these, and then you have to actually do the integrals to get the prefactors. In the homework, you actually don't have to do the integrals to get the prefactors. I just tell you, you just reduce them to dimensionless integrals, and then I just in the notes I tell you the answers to those integrals. If you want to work out the answers yourself, you're welcome to. But yeah.
Sorry, what? How are we getting energy? Temperature as a dimensional quantity that's much greater than the mass.
So this is one limit of this distribution function that we can consider. So in other words, there are the quantities that vary over phase space, the pressure and the momentum p and the position x. But then there are the fixed quantities that go in to specify the distribution function, the mass of the particle, which goes into its energy. Which comes into the relation between the energy and the momentum, and these two thermodynamic quantities, the chemical potential and the temperature. So we're saying assume that we're in the limit where the temperature, we're talking about a gas that is heated up to a temperature that is huge relative to the mass of the particles. So the temperature is the typical energy that the particles are flying around with. So assume we're talking about a gas of particles that are flying around with energies that are gigantic relative to their rest mass. So very highly relativistic. In that limit, we're evaluating these expressions, and you're going to show in the homework that they're approximately equal to this. In that limit.
Thinking of KT as the energy.
Oh yes, sorry. You're absolutely right. I usually you would see a K Boltzmann here, and you're absolutely right that without even mentioning it, I set K Boltzmann equal to 1. That's going to be a general. What?
You did mention it.
After I wrote it, yes. Sorry. So I'm. This is going to be routinely the case that I'm going to use K Boltzmann, H bar and C is equal to 1 without remembering to mention it. Another thing, while I'm busy mentioning things that I'll forget, G Newton. So in these units, when I take these guys all equal to 1, G Newton has units of 1 over mass squared. It's a quantity of units 1 over mass squared, and that guy is nothing but 1 over the Planck mass squared. That's the so-called Planck mass. Where the Planck mass is about 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay, so that's one limit. In particular, notice that the ratio here of pi to rho I is equal to 1/3. So in other words, that's the equation of state parameter. So in yesterday's lecture, I argued why a gas of relativistic particles, as the universe expands, should have equation of state parameter equal to 1/3. But if you look closely at my argument, it was just imagining that all these particles were free particles, not running into anything. So here, this calculation shows that even when they're all banging into each other and maintaining thermal equilibrium with one another, it still is the case that their equation of state parameter is 1/3. Okay. Now the other limit, The other limit is that is the opposite, the non-relativistic limit, when the when t becomes less than the mass of the particle. Okay, and we're going to talk about the non-degenerate limit. So we're not talking about like a Bose-Einstein condensate or a particle that or fermions that are condensed to the I'm blanking on the term. What is the we're not talking about a degenerate Fermi gas. What is this guy called? So in the distribution function, when they all clump up at low energies. Oh wow. Sorry? Sorry, I couldn't hear.
No.
The Fermi surface. So we're not talking about the situation where there's a well-defined Fermi surface. Like, you know, when you take the Fermi direct distribution to sufficiently low temperatures, the relative to the chemical potential, there's like a very sharp wall distribution function as you go to lower momenta. Anyway, so I just wanted to say, so we're talking about the case where mi is greater than the chemical potential here. So in other words, we're not talking about these degenerate Fermi or Bose gases that you might meet in a statistical mechanics course, like that you might deal with in a cold, low temperature laboratory in physics. But nevertheless, they're non-relativistic. So in that limit, again, if you evaluate these expressions approximately, then okay, then, well, first of all, this guy is very intuitive. The energy density in that limit is just the number density times the mass of the ith species. So in other words, the energy of each particle is dominated by its mass. So the total energy is just the sum of the masses of the particles. And so their energy density is just their mass times their number density. Meanwhile, the pressure in this limit turns out to be the temperature times the number density. So note again that here, in the limit that Ti is much less than Mi, this is saying that Pi over rho I is approximately zero. In other words, the equation of state parameter for non-relativistic matter is approximately zero. So again, that's the same answer that we got yesterday. But yesterday, my argument imagined that all the particles were sitting there, free particles in this box, not interacting with one another. So again, we're seeing you get the same answer even when they're colliding with one another and in thermal equilibrium. Then this guy, you actually have to calculate. And it's given by a formula like this. Mi times the temperature, I to the 3/2 power, and then times exponential of mu I minus mi over ti. Okay, so what is the important thing that this is saying? This is saying that suppose you have some particle species that's in thermal equilibrium and it has mass mi. Okay, you have some particle of mass mi. And now, as we'll see in a minute, I haven't actually derived this for you yet, but we'll do that in the next step here. But as we'll see, as the universe expands, if you have sort of a gas in thermal equilibrium and the universe expands, the temperature of that gas drops with time. And so initially, the temperature, in the very early universe, the temperature will be much greater than Mi. And there will be a lot of that species, okay? There will be a number density of that species given by this formula, but then as the universe cools, eventually you'll reach some point where the temperature drops below the mass of the particle, and then this formula ceases to be valid, and suddenly, after the mass drops below the temperature, well, you know, again, this is some positive number. Let's say of order the mass. As the temperature drops below the mass, this becomes this guy becomes exponentially suppressed. This becomes e to the minus some big negative number. So it becomes Boltzmann suppressed. So suddenly, as the temperature drops below the mass, thermal equilibrium wants to get rid of that particle as fast as possible. It wants to drive its number density to zero. So suddenly, that particle wants to decay or annihilate any way it can to be in accord with the requirements of thermodynamics. And so that is what happens. But you know that that can only go on for so long. So an important thing that happens in cosmology is that this is kind of a thing that happens again and again, that you have some particle species or you have some excited state, when the temperature of the universe is high relative to that excited state, or relative to that the mass of that particle, the universe is happy to produce that particle. It's the abundance of that particle is about the same as the abundance of every other relativistic particle. But then suddenly, when the universe drops below the threshold energy for that particle, so for that state, so below the mass of the particle in the case of a particle, the particle wants to annihilate. Suddenly it's becoming rare, exponentially rare. But you know, yeah.
This might be a silly question, but if large numbers of this particle were favorable, later smaller numbers of the particle were favorable, what exactly happened to missing particles? Where did they go?
Good question. So you know. That's exactly what I'll be about. I'll explain that in 1 second. You know, at some point, there are some actual physical reactions. You know, thermal equilibrium does not just occur by magic. There's some actual physical reactions that are responsible for creating particles or getting rid of them to maintain the distribution required by thermal equilibrium. But at some point, those particle species may become so rare in the universe that the reactions that are required to maintain the thermal equilibrium distribution just cannot occur fast enough to maintain thermal equilibrium, and the particle falls out of thermal equilibrium. So the classic example of this is, we really don't know what the dark matter is, but for a reason that we'll see in a subsequent lecture, arguably our best hint, or arguably the the most popular model for what the dark matter is, for a reason that we'll see in the next lecture, hopefully, it gets kind of one pat on the back, this argument, from observations of the universe. Which is more than any other model of dark matter gets. So it's, in that sense, it's the leading contender. But this is total speculation. But nevertheless, one classic model for what dark matter is it's some weakly interacting particle chi, which with mass m chi. And a chi particle by itself is stable. It cannot decay. So if you just have a chi particle by itself, it'll sit around just like a proton and last for the age of the universe, but chi and its antiparticle can annihilate, and this is supposed to be the picture of what the dark matter is today, that there is some chi particle called a weakly interacting massive particle, a WIMP, the idea is that Its mass can be kind of a standard mass of that we see in the low energy universe. You know, it can be kind of 1 GeV. And its annihilation cross section can be the typical annihilation cross section that you expect for weakly interacting massive particles. What happens? So there's some reaction there's some physical reaction where a chi and an anti-chi come in and they annihilate to something. I don't know, maybe a through some intermediate state, maybe a W boson, they interact, maybe they annihilate, let's say, to two photons. Okay, so that's some physically allowed Feynman diagram. That's the leading way. Let's say that's the leading way for this particle to decay, and that'll have some cross section that is of order a typical weak annihilation cross section. So in the early universe, when the temperature is high relative to the mass of chi, there's tons of chi particles. There's tons of anti-chi particles. When the temperature is high, there's enough photons and enough chi particles, and it's thermodynamically favorable. This reaction is going back and forth in both directions very rapidly relative to the expansion rate of the universe. So this guy has no trouble maintaining its thermal equilibrium distribution. But when the temperature gets sufficiently low, thermal equilibrium drives the density of these guys down. And then at some point, and we'll quantify this, we'll see how to quantify this later in the lecture, but at some point, the number density of chi particles and chi twiddle particles becomes so low that a chi particle moving along is just unlikely to ever meet another chi twiddle particle. Like it's moving through the universe, and the density of chi twiddle particles has become so low that it's just becomes improbable that this guy will ever manage to run into another guy to annihilate with. So at that point, the thermal equilibrium distribution has to fail. The exponential suppression stops. These guys never manage to find each other and annihilate again. After that, their total number is conserved. Okay, so after that point, the total number of chi particles is conserved. The volume of the box that it's in is growing proportional to a cubed. And so the number per volume, the number density, after it drops out of thermal equilibrium, just drops as 1 upon a cubed. So the idea, the sense in which the universe gives this model a pat on the back is just that for kind of reasonable standard masses, particle masses, hypothetical masses, and cross-sections, annihilation cross-sections for the chi particle, if you go through this calculation, you say, okay, originally this chi particle is in thermal equilibrium, then it became non-relativistic, it began to be exponentially suppressed, but at some point, that exponential suppression froze out. Okay, there was so-called freeze out, which is sort of the standard term to describe when these guys can no longer find each other to annihilate and maintain thermal equilibrium. Then suddenly the number of particles was frozen in and just decayed. You can calculate when that happened, and then you can say, okay, how much did the universe expand since then? And so what is the expected number density today? And then you can calculate the energy density today, the mass of that particle, the energy density today, which is then the mass of that particle times the number density today. And you know, the turns out that when you go through that calculation, you get a density of chi particles today, an energy density, which is comparable to the observed dark matter density today. So that is the so-called WIMP miracle. Miracle is too strong a term. It's not terribly strong evidence that this is the correct model of what the dark matter is, but it is a little bit of evidence in this paradigm's favor. In any case, it gives a good model for the sort of calculation that one often does when you have a new model for beyond the standard model physics. You want to sort of go through and ask, well, what are the different massive particles in that theory, and what are their cross sections? As the universe cools down, they will all freeze out with some relic abundance, and I had better make sure that none of them freeze out so that today they're predicted to have a relic abundance that's huge relative to the total observed energy density in the universe today. You know, I have to make sure that they don't have an abundance that's huge relative to the observational constraints today. On the other hand, if it contains a particle that where I go through and I calculate the observed the predicted freeze-out abundance today, and that freeze-out abundance happens to automatically match the observed dark matter density today, you know, then that's good. That's a very important bit of evidence in favor of your theory of beyond the standard model physics. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, that wasn't the board I wanted to send to the back, but anyway. Yes.
Two small questions. First, the temperature is particle dependent?
It can be. Usually, you know, in the simplest case, everything is just in thermal equilibrium with everything, and then they all have the same temperature. But it can happen that you have basically you can have one subset of particles that are colliding happily with one another, but that are weakly coupled to it, and there's another subgroup of particles that are colliding happily, and they can have two different temperatures.
Another thing was, what determines mu physically? Because,
you know, physically you can think of, you know, that mu is like when you just like the temperature. Remember, in thermodynamics, the temperature basically is the thing that when two systems can exchange entropy, can exchange heat. One heat flows from one into the other until their temperatures become equal. Similarly, when two systems can exchange particle number, statistically, two particles the particles flow from one to the other until their chemical potentials equilibrate. But that's maybe the more helpful thing to say here is that chemical potentials in cosmology show up when there's a conserved quantity that prevents. Okay, like so. Let's say that the only particles in the universe were. So take this example. Suppose the only particles in the universe were positrons and electrons, which both have exactly the same mass, and they're bumping into one another. Okay, and photons. So they're just QED with only photons and electrons. So there's a reaction that can produce a pair of these guys out of two photons, or these two guys can annihilate to produce two photons. So they can maintain thermal equilibrium nicely. And so you would say, well, okay, so if they both have the same mass, I'm having a hard time spitting out a simple thing. So the point is, there is another thing in QED, which is there's charge conservation. Okay, charge is conserved. So suppose that the universe has some net charge. Suppose that there's an excess of positrons over electrons. Well, that's a conserved quantity. Thermodynamics can do all it wants, but it can't change the fact that there should be an excess of that the universe has to maintain this conserved quantity, an excess of positive charge over negative charge. So if I look at the distribution functions for these two guys, one guy has the distribution function exponential of energy minus mu plus over t plus 1. And the other guy has exponential of energy minus mu minus over t plus 1. Now the energy here, the energy is p squared plus m squared in both cases. And in both cases, the m is exactly the same for the positron and the electron. They're just antiparticles of one another. So if they had the same chemical potentials, thermal equilibrium would predict that they had the same distribution functions. It would predict there was no excess of plus charges over minus charges. But there has to be. This conserved quantity says the thermal equilibrium can't get us into that state. So instead, the presence of this conserved charge, the presence of this excess of of positive charge over negative charge, which has to be conserved even in thermal equilibrium, will be reflected by the fact that these two particles will have different chemical potentials in that case. Okay, and so every time you have a conserved quantity like that, there's an associated chemical potential which appropriately modifies the distribution function to say that thermodynamics can only go as far as toward thermal equilibrium as conservation will allow.
I suppose my problem is that we can choose mu such that there is no annihilation, right? We can choose mu as a function of temperature such that particle number is constant, which is what you normally do in classical physics.
You can choose mu as a function of temperature.
Well, if you work in an isolated system, in classical mechanics, you want your number of particles to be constant, and mu is then a meaningless symbol that just chooses in function of temperature, so that is true. If you have an isolated system.
So it's similar here that you can choose. So if the number of some particle in a given box is conserved, then it's the same sort of thing.
But you're saying there's annihilation, so there isn't conservation.
Well, if two particles can annihilate, so in this case, if these two guys can annihilate to particles that carry no conserved quantities, then yeah, they have to have the same chemical potential. But in normal statistical mechanics, in the system, this physical system is not the one you're thinking about where the particle number is conserved. You know, you're thinking about a system where you have like atoms in the room here, where there's no anti-atoms for them to annihilate with. There's no physical process by which you can just get rid of the atoms in the room. So they have a fixed number, and so like you say, the chemical potential has to be adjusted to ensure that thermodynamics is consistent with that number staying fixed. But here there's nothing like that. Let's see. Another thing I wanted to mention was so in terms of the energy density and pressure, you can calculate the entropy density of the fluid in question. It's given by rho plus p over t. So I give an argument in the notes about why that is. I won't go through that right here. But so the point is, in the relativistic case, we had these expressions for rho and p, which were both proportional to t to the fourth. So this is t to the fourth plus t to the fourth over t. So this guy is equal to some, again, there's some prefactor. Proportional to t cubed. Okay, now we should ask, in the expanding universe, why are we talking about thermal equilibrium? Why are we using these thermal equilibrium distribution functions in the expanding universe? I mean, after all, the universe is not in equilibrium; it's expanding, right? I mean, it's changing. It's not reached some quiescent state. So, the answer is that if the physical reactions that are necessary for maintaining equilibrium are occurring with a rate that is very high relative to the expansion rate, then the universe is approximately in thermal equilibrium at a given time. So that, so in other words, if there's some reaction necessary to maintain the equilibrium distribution. So again, if this is the reaction that's necessary to maintain the chi particles at their equilibrium distribution, then the rate of if the rate of that reaction is happening is huge relative to h, well, you know, h, well, each of these, 1 over gamma here is the typical time that a chi particle has to wait before it experiences one of those reactions. Whereas h is 1 over h, that's the typical time that you have to, that's the time you have to wait for the universe to expand by a significant amount. You know, 1 over h is basically the amount of time that it will take the universe to expand from a given size to about e times that size. Okay, so if h is much less than gamma, that's saying that the time that it takes the universe to expand a significant amount is huge relative to the time, the typical time scale for the reactions that maintain equilibrium. So in other words, over the typical time scale required to bring this gas into thermal equilibrium, the universe has basically not evolved at all. As far as this gas is concerned, the universe has just been at a fixed static size over the time required for it to come into equilibrium. So it's a very good approximation to say that the system does reach thermal equilibrium. This is the limit in which the universe is expanding this box adiabatically. It's like when you have a piston, you have some gas in here with some thermodynamic quantities. If you expand the piston sufficiently slowly, and the limit that you expand the piston very slowly, the thermodynamic quantities just ooze to different values with time. But you never really leave thermal equilibrium to any appreciable extent. And in particular, when you never leave thermal equilibrium in an adiabatic process, the entropy doesn't change. You don't generate any entropy. That's what I want to say. So in the limit that the reactions required for maintaining thermal equilibrium of the gas are large, the rates are large relative to the expansion rate, the total entropy doesn't change appreciably. The expansion of the universe is an adiabatic expansion. So the total entropy in this box remains constant, and again, the physical volume of the box grows as A cubed. So the entropy density, the entropy per volume, will go down as A to the minus 3. But we also see that the entropy is proportional to T cubed. So comparing these two expressions, we extract this important result that for a gas of radiation in nearly thermal equilibrium, just adiabatically expanding with the universe, the temperature goes down as 1 upon A. Now there can be events in the universe's history, like phase transitions, that go way out of equilibrium, in which case during those events this rule will break, but for most of the universe's history, and in particular between Big Bang nucleosynthesis and today, it turns out that this has been very well satisfied. Yeah.
What is the symbol in the upper formula all the way on the
right-hand
side in the
denominator after the 4? 5. That says 45. Yes, I apologize. You're making me feel inadequate about the 5. Okay, so let's see. I think that's really all I wanted to say about in terms of lecture 7. So let me in the final 5 minutes introduce you to George Gamow. And in the next lecture, we'll just want to see, see his basically back. You know, George Gamow is this guy. He's this classic example of a theorist. You know, so at PI, theorist means one thing. PI is this place that glorifies sophisticated mathematics and that's basically a good summary. And but you know, there's this other type of theorist who which you don't meet as much in like problem sets or and maybe is like a little bit rarer. But you know, it's important to understand that there's this other type of thing you're supposed to do in theory, which is equally awesome, if not awesomer, which is just like notice that there is some huge problem that no one else has noticed, like some huge unexplained feature of the universe that no one else has just noticed, and then figure out, dream up some explanation for it, even though there's no well-defined theory at the moment to systematically account for it. Okay, you have to dream up the theory and then do some. And so usually in those situations, you know, the crucial step is like just dreaming up some crazy model. So being imaginative about dreaming up a model that accounts for some strange phenomenon well, and hopefully predicts some other thing. And usually the initial model is very crude and the calculations are sort of, you're flying by the seat of your pants and, you know, I don't know. So Gamow is like, was like crazy good at this. And so he has many of the discoveries. You know, there was this early period like before the 50s when quantum field theory didn't make any sense yet. No one knew how to calculate it. But there were a bunch of geniuses, basically, Fermi and Gamow and a couple people like this, who nevertheless, just by magic, basically, kind of patched together what turned out to be very accurate calculations of phenomena that we would today calculate with quantum, you know, according to the more systematic rules of quantum field theory. So they were able to calculate, for example, before I even tell you that, I just want to give another example of an awesome thing that George Gamow did, just to give a flavor of the kind of guy, right? So right after Watson and Crick discovered that DNA was a double helix, the double helix structure of DNA. Okay, so it's some double helix and each of these strands is a sequence of four different letters, you know, and then the complementary letters along this strand. Okay, so they discovered that fact, and it was clear that somehow this string of letters was encoding the transcription of proteins in your body. It was telling your body what proteins to make and how. And the question was just how, you know, how is the structure of proteins encoded in this sequence? And Gamow was the one who figured that out. He said, you know, okay, well there's four letters in my alphabet. His argument was there's four letters in my alphabet. Proteins, it was already known back then, are made up of 20, I forget, I think it's 22 or 20 amino acids, I don't even remember. Proteins are strings of 22 amino acids or 20, it doesn't matter. For this argument, it doesn't matter. For your life, it matters. But so he just said, okay, well, the simplest thing for nature to do would be to, you know, just have some string of some string of letters be a word that encodes one of the amino acids. And well, if each word was only one letter long, then we would only be able to encode four amino acids because there's only four different letters. If each word was only two letters long, we would only be able to encode 16 amino acids, four times four. So that's not enough. So if each word is three letters long, then that's just enough to encode all of the 22 distinct amino acids. You know, evolution probably went with the simplest choice. So he guesses that DNA is written in triplet code, and that guess is right. So that's like a Gamow argument. That stuff is genius. I just want to say that's a very unsophisticated but extremely ingenious argument. If you can make one argument like that in your life, you're doing good. Okay, but so I wanted to tell you, so similarly, he was the person who figured out that the light elements in the periodic table were synthesized not in the centers of stars, like the rest of the elements in the periodic table are synthesized in stars. So you know you have the here's the periodic table, the best that I understand it. Okay, some box, and this is like hydrogen, and this is helium, and then elements get heavier and heavier. Okay, and so you know again these geniuses in the 30s and 40s and 50s. They understood that at the centers of stars, that the reason the stars were shining was that they were you know burning nuclear fuel. They were taking light elements and fusing them into heavier and heavier elements under the intense gravitational pressure of the star. And in that way, they were able to calculate to a remarkable extent they were able to understand how the various elements in the how the cosmological abundances of the various elements in the periodic table were obtained. And so, you know, in particular, up to iron, which is somewhere in the middle, about halfway through, up to iron, those things are cooked basically in the centers of stars, and then everything above iron, including you know thorium and uranium and plutonium and the elements that are you know important for nuclear reactors or nuclear bombs, those are produced when stars explode and you have a shock wave going out. So the sort of roughly speaking, everything up here is cooked in equilibrium in the center of the stars. Everything past here is cooked in an out of equilibrium shock wave coming out of the star. But Gamow realized that those explanations could not account for the abundance of the first four elements, hydrogen, helium, lithium, and beryllium. And so he got to thinking about what the other explanation, where those things could come from, because these are really, hydrogen is 75% of the universe by mass, helium is 25% of the universe, and the remaining elements are all really trace amounts. So it's very important to ask, where did these guys come from? And so I'll show you next time a very simple back of the envelope calculation. Using the tools that we derived in the previous part of the lecture, is able to show that these guys are not done in the centers of stars. That in fact, if you just follow the expansion of the universe between about 1 second and 3 minutes after the Big Bang, simple arguments shows you get roughly in the right ballpark for these guys. And so that's an awesome argument. And then towards the end of tomorrow's lecture, we'll also see how he predicted the cosmic microwave background, and we'll talk about its basic properties. Okay?